This is the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
What's good, Front Row family? This is Derek Young, co-owner and founder of Mahogany Books. I'm excited to bring you this special episode of Mahogany Books Front Row featuring author Kennedy Ryan at our 2025 Black Books Matter Fest in Oxon Hill, Maryland. If you've ever been to any of our events, you know the Mahogany Books experience is unlike any other book event you've ever attended. We believe in joyful gatherings that celebrate our culture, build community, and enable honest conversations. When you listen to this episode, we hope you feel the energy that permeated that entire day, where over 5,000 plus book readers joined us for a celebration of Black literary excellence that stands firm against erasure while proudly claiming agency over our stories, heritage, and joy. Peace. What I'm assuming is everyone is here for Kennedy Ryan.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, hello, hello. If you can hear me, snap some fingers. Yes, if you can hear me, snap some fingers. Okay, I know who our audience is. So really quickly, I know who y'all are here to see, okay? We know who you guys are here to see. And I'm just elated to have you all here. My name is Ramunda Young. My husband and I own Mahogany Books. And thank you, I see you, thank you, thank you. Just really quickly, Mahogany Books, we've been in business for 18 years. Yes, yes. And we've been here at the Harbor for 4. And my husband and I have been married for 23 years, so this is just a labor of love all the way around, all the way around. So really quickly, we're gonna bring out Kennedy, she is here. I want to say something. Yeah. Oh, yes. Y'all can clap for Kennedy. Y'all ready?
Yeah.
I know y'all ready. really quickly. So Kennedy Ryan is a New York Times best-selling author. She is a USA Today best-selling author. Yep. Yep. She has more than 20 books. Titles, written, all of that, more than 20. Let me see, by show of hands, who has more than 5 of Kennedy's books? All right, y'all in the right place, okay. She is the first Black author ever to win the Rita Award, AKA the Oscar of Romance. She is also the co-founder, she created a nonprofit called Lift for Autism, so I just love that she did that. But she's also a proud mom, a proud wife, and I am beyond honored to have this conversation with Kennedy Ryan. So please, before I say please, when we start talking, just use y'all quiet voice, because I want y'all to hear everything, all right? Yeah. All right, please do. But y'all, please help me welcome the amazing Kennedy Ryan!
Hi, everybody.
We're in here. How y'all feeling? Sisters, y'all all right? Brother, okay, it's not too many brothers. I'm just joking. Kennedy, thank you. Thank you for being here today.
No, thank you for having me. You know, as soon as you asked me, you were like, you don't have to. I was like, no, I'm coming. I want to come. I love you guys. I love what you do for Black bookstores, what you do for Black readers, what you do for Black authors. It's an honor. Absolutely. And oh my gosh, there's so many of you. Hi. Y'all are crammed in here. Thank you for coming.
Face.
I know. I need to angle.
Me too. I need to see your face.
Angle.
So let's get into it, honey.
Okay.
So my first question. So the other thing is too. I'm gonna leave some questions space for you guys to ask questions about the book specifically, because I know y'all have plenty of them. And so when you're finish, just raise your hand and speak loudly. Okay? Can you guys honor that? Let me hear some finger snaps. Can y'all do that? Yeah. We want to make sure we can get some questions in. So yeah, let's get into it. So Kennedy, this Skyland series. Yeah. This Skyland series has all of us in a literary chokehold. I'm just gonna be honest. Kennedy, a literary chokehold, right? And running a business and being a wife and mom, I found myself reading this book at the stoplight, at the doctor's office, walking the dog that I don't have. I was just outside, just... I had it on audiobook, physical book.
I was gonna say, audio!
Both of them. So I just wanna say thank you for that, because we need this space to read about us in the way that you've written about us. So thank you for that. Thank you for that.
Right. I thank everybody for the support. You know, this series has changed my career, changed my life, changed my family's life, and I'm really humbled by how everybody has supported it.
Thank you. So tell us about 10-year-old Kennedy. That's what I really want to know. Tell me about 10-year-old Kennedy and the dream she dreamt for herself, and how close are you to that dream right now?
You know, 10-year-old Kennedy, first of all, was just such a bookworm. I mean, like, my mom would tease me because in the summertime, I would stay inside and read books all the time. She was like, you are the only little black girl I know who gets paler in the summer. And I would stay up all night, and I would have dark circles under my eyes. And this is, I'm older than everybody, so this was before we could read on a phone. I would have a flashlight, you know, in bed, under the cover, reading. So I've been a reader and reader obsessed forever. But when 10-year-old Kennedy, I think I thought I was gonna be a lawyer or an actress or, you know, because I love to talk. And communication is really big for me. But by the time I was like 12, I knew I was gonna be a writer. My dad is like a dean, he works in higher education administration, so he's like a president. He works with HBCUs, actually. So he was, when I was growing up, he was like a dean of students, then he was the president, then he was the chancellor of a couple of HBCUs. So he was very buttoned up, you know, and very like dum, 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 dum. And my whole life, he was in school, getting his master's, getting his PhD, all of this stuff. So I always saw him as like, kind of like this. And then one day I was in the garage or something, and I came across a box of poetry. And I was asking my mom, I was like, who wrote this? She's like, your dad. And I was like, my dad? Him? And I started reading his poetry, and I was like, this is amazing. I want to do this, you know? And I just started writing poetry. And I wasn't sure how it would shape up, but I knew that words meant a lot to me. And my father he was gone a lot. Like I said, he was working, but he was also in school at the time. And I told you I'm old, so there was no online, you know? So he would go to school just at night. He would work all day, and then he would go to school at night, and then he would come home late. And he would quiz me. He would assign me sections of the dictionary to read, like the letter C, you know? And he would come home and we would quiz each other on C word. C word is not the best example. G words, okay? That's better, a little. He'd be like, okay, and you know, he'd fire off a G word, then I'd fire off a G word. We'd go back and forth until we stumped each other. I know that's really nerdy. But really early on, he told me, he was like, anytime you encounter a word that you don't know, write it down and use it within the week. And that started building my vocabulary, but it started building a love for language. And so I pretty early realized I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't think I wanted to write novels. I thought I wanted to be a journalist, which is what I did. By the time I was a senior in high school, I started writing for my city newspaper. And I was writing editorials, and I don't know why they trusted a 17-year-old me with an editorial, like with my whole chest, like I knew what I was talking about. But that was kind of my first taste of like writing in a space where people consumed it, and you got feedback when I was 17. Then I went on to journalism school, and I thought I was going to be reporting from like war-torn countries. You know, but no, I'm writing romance, which is funner.
So is 10-year-old Kennedy proud?
Yeah, I think so. I think she would be surprised, you know? First of all, you have to understand, she probably didn't think she would be a romance writer because my mom is a preacher. Yeah. And I was not allowed to read romance. And so in the eighth grade, I started smuggling romance novels into my house. And I would hide them in my pants. I would hide them in purses. They were stuffed in my mattress. I had about 300 Harlequins in the back of my closet behind clothes. And I did not tell my mom I had done that till I was 30, you know? So my mom is surprised that I'm a romance novelist, since she forebode, or forbade me to read romance. Little did she know I was off, off reading everything I could get my hands on. So, yeah.
I love that. I was reading Harlequin books too. Yes. And I'm from Oklahoma, so I was not even exposed to Black books. Oh. So there was not... I can't even recall black romance writers back then.
Yeah, no, and I'm from the country, mm-hmm. Very rural. So we had like this small library that did not have a lot of diversity as far as romance. We had diversity as far as like more literary fiction, because you'd have Toni Morrison, yes. and you'd have Zora Neale Hurston, and you have stuff like that. But in romance, there just wasn't very much.
Yeah, same. So thank you. We got romance now, honey. Thank you. So I read somewhere, and I could be wrong, but I read somewhere that you pick real actors and musicians who resemble your characters down to their voice, their vibe and style. Is this true? And if not, who were some of your inspos for the Skyland series? Do you do that?
I think it's true-ish.
Okay.
I think a lot of authors will have like a mood board, a Pinterest board. So I'll usually do that. Like when I was writing the Skyland series, I think I envisioned, and we're casting for it now. We're casting for it. So.
We ready.
In the process of that whole process, we have a long, long way to go. So when I say these things, I'm not like saying, this is who it should be. I'm really careful about that, because whomever we cast, I don't want them to ever get a hold of a video where I was like, yeah, I really didn't want him, But I did envision like Aldous Hodge. I envisioned him as Josiah. And I think I had a few Yasmins, like Tika Sumter and Shannon Thorpe, and I think Shannon Thornton, who's on P-Valley. She's my main one. I can't think. She was in that, Clone Tyrone. Do you know who I'm talking about? Gosh, that was gonna drive me crazy. I'm gonna have to look. but because it's gonna drive me crazy, you guys. I won't be able to move on. Tiana Paris.
Yes.
My mind is bad. Tiana Paris. So, for Hendrix, Wonmi, I think her name is Wonmi, who was, she was in Sinners. That was my, that has always been my Hendrix. I get a lot of suggestions, but in my mind as I was writing, that was my Hendrix. But I also, even beyond the physicality, like I'm writing Score now, which is the follow-up to Real. And the hero is a very accomplished musician, and it's not a physical inspiration, but I don't know if you guys know John Baptiste, who is like this amazing musician. That's kind of my like type inspiration, not physically, but just like all of his musicality and the breadth of his experience as, as an artist.
I love how you're thinking, especially when you talked about Hendrix and just how you're processing and having people that could really represent us in such a powerful way. So I just love how you're processing that. And so I was just reading, this can't get enough. It's got us all on lockdown. But you've been courageous in using your voice to incorporate social justice issues between the pages of a romance novel. Why was that important to you? And how did your earlier audiences react? Were you nervous? Were they like, what is she doing?
Yeah, no, I think that my readership has evolved a lot because I've evolved a lot, as a writer. I think that I am, like, if you've ever, these personality tests, and I can't think of the one that it is right now, but it's the strengths test. Okay. If anybody knows the strengths test, like, I'm like number two belief. Which is really, really high, and it's like what you believe, your convictions, you're trying to save the world, like those things really drive you as far as a personality, and it makes its way into everything that I do. I heard you talking about Lyft for Autism, which of course is the book auction we use to raise money for autism. Before that, I started a foundation for families who have children with autism that I ran for 11 years. Like, I just am always like, here's a problem, where do I fit into the solution? So I've always kind of thought thought like that, but I don't think that that kind of missional mindset entered my writing until later. I kind of stumbled into writing fiction. Like I said, I thought I was gonna be like a journalist. I mentioned my son was diagnosed with autism, and this was over 20 years ago, which is a very different landscape for autism then, especially as far as like things getting paid for. Mm-hmm. Everything was out of pocket. We've evolved a lot. And so when my son was diagnosed with autism, he was diagnosed on a Thursday, and my husband lost his job on the next day. And I was like, gosh, this is really expensive. How are we gonna do this? And I just kind of threw myself into advocating for him and to getting him all that he needed. And then when I saw how woeful the landscape was as far as resources, and then also how it disproportionately impacted marginalized kids, mm-hmm. in a different way, I really wanted to get involved. So I started this foundation. And then my writing during that period of my life was almost exclusively around autism. You know, it was around advocacy. It was writing for like special needs parents for magazines where we're talking about autism and, you know, the journey of a special needs parent. So all my writing was autism. I was, you know, started and ran a foundation for families who have children with autism, and I'm raising my kid and doing all that he needs. And I'm like, oh, my whole life is all of this. And I really needed something just for myself, which is how I got back to reading romance. Cause, you know, during college, I kind of like started reading all the serious books. But I needed something that was just for me, and I started reading romance again, and then that evolved into me wanting to write it. But I kind of stumbled into it. Like, I was in a writer's group, and we would invite, they would have conferences, and they would invite down, like, agents from New York and editors from New York, and you would pitch. And so they were like, well, you should pitch just for practice, because nothing's going to happen. And I was like, oh, I know, nothing's going to happen. First of all, my book was, like, three times as long as it should have been. So I'm pitching it to them, and they had said to me, if they just don't want anything to do with it, which is probably what'll happen, they'll just be like, thanks. If they're kind of interested, they'll say, send a partial. Okay. And if they're really interested, they'll say, send me the full. And they were like, that's not gonna happen, baby. I was like, I know, but this is good practice. So I only made appointments with one agent and one editor. And the agent was like, send me the full. And I was like, send you the full. Well, wait a minute. I thought that means that she was like, send me the full. And then I met with one editor, and she was like, send me the full. And I was like, but I thought that, wait, what? And like within a month, the book was sold and I had an agent. And I was like, I thought I was gonna have all this time. You know, like everybody was gonna have a stack of rejection letters. It's gonna take years and years and years. And it happened like that. And so I was kind of just thrust into being a writer, like writing fiction. And I think at first I was a little aimless. Like, okay, what do we write? What are people writing? What's selling? Okay, that's what I'll do, okay. And then I've talked about this somewhere maybe around, I don't know, book seven, book six, somewhere between book six and eight, somewhere around there, it started feeling kind of hollow for me. Okay. And I was like, why doesn't this feel meaningful? And everything I do has meaning attached to it. So how do I make sure that this art reflects my beliefs and my convictions and my priorities? And so I had already built a readership who loved what I was doing.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.
And there's nothing wrong with my earliest books. Like, they're well-written books because I've been a writer for 30 years, so I should hope they would be. But as I started figuring out, I really want these books to reflect my convictions, my priorities, your readership does start to change. Some start to drop off. Mm-hmm. And then some new ones come, and they're like, oh, I love what you're doing now. And you just kind of start recomplecting and rebuilding what your audience looks like. But I'm really fortunate that I realized that early. Mm-hmm. And so the audience, you guys, you know, it what I have now and who is reading me now, they wouldn't open a book like Queen Move and see me talking about, you know, the Crown Act and hair discrimination, or they wouldn't open a book like Can't Get Enough, you know, and see me talking about, you know, the fact that equity is under fire. You know, they wouldn't, the audience I have now would not open a book and be surprised. They'd be like, well, that's what Kennedy does. And so I think there's definitely been a shift, but it happened so early that now I feel really surrounded by readers who are aligned with me. That does not mean that I don't still sometimes, you know, encounter readers in my space who don't agree with me. I was sharing the other day in transparency, I was sharing the other day about Gaza and how I wanted to see them eat, you know, which I thought was pretty basic, you know, and I had people coming in my DMs, oh, Kennedy, with your selective activism, and I'm gonna burn your books, and I'm gonna, and I was like,
wow.
Go ahead. You know, I'm like,
Kennedy,
you know, I mean, you know, I really, I have had publishers, you know, when I have posted about Gaza and wanting them to have food, like, which what I thought was pretty basic, I've had foreign publishers come to me and say, we're gonna take your books down unless you apologize, unless you, and I had some, my agent, I think, came to me and said that, and I said, would you please kindly tell them to fuck off? And I'm like, tell them that they don't know who they have. Like, they don't know who I am. If, and that's not like they don't know who I am. They don't, maybe they haven't read my books. Maybe they haven't heard me talk. Maybe they don't know that you cannot buy me.
Yes.
That you cannot hold that over my head as a threat and expect me to respond to you in the way you think. You know, and I think that that same, like, conviction, that same understanding that success is very fragile, you know, and like at a certain time, you might have to make a decision that threatens success, that threatens your money, that threatens your sales, and who are you going to be?
But I love that, and I love it because you've stood just flat-footed in who you are, and your tribe found you. And I think sometimes we're so busy tap dancing to find a tribe versus just allowing you to be yourself and your tribe be attracted to you. So I love that you did that. And I think even as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, I was always nervous because we really just went into the space of all just black books. And some people were like, well, you should have some of the best sellers and all this. I said, but I want just the black books. And a lot of us are not on the best sellers looks. But it took a lot of confidence just to stand flat-footed in that niche and to be celebrated just for being authentically who we are. And so I love that you have done that. And all these people have been attractive to you and your authenticity, just standing flat-footed in who you are. And that takes courage, because it's so easy to be moved by so many things that are out there. So.
Well, and I feel like we're in a space right now where storytellers, writers, artists, like, we have to do that. We are watching the fall of democracy and the rise of fascism. And we are watching an attack on our history, where literally our stories and our history is being deleted. It's being, history is being changed right before our eyes. We are the keepers of that. You know, we're the ones who have to tell those stories. You know, Nina Simone, which is, I have certain quotes that are like guiding quotes for me. I have them up on walls and my laptop. And Nina Simone said, an artist's duty is to reflect the times. And so I know people are like, romance, you know, romance can't do that. And I'm like, yeah, it actually can. And not only can it do that, it's the most digestive and palatable genre there is. So when I see romance as a Trojan horse, where I'm smuggling in discourse and I'm smuggling in all these, like, wrapped around inside the spice and the swoons and all of that, is something that's gonna cause people to interrogate their beliefs and to think about something that maybe they wouldn't. I think romance is a very natural space to do those things, because when people are enjoying themselves, their walls come down, you know, and that's how I see my platform.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt that it's wrapped in a billionaire brother, married. It doesn't hurt, I'm just saying, it doesn't hurt. But I love that, a Trojan horse, because it's working. And I think for me, as a black woman who never saw herself on the covers, I need to let you know that I feel affirmed, I feel seen, I feel beautiful. I can just sit in my chocolateness. As a little kid, I was teased about it often. Like, oh, you're so dark. But I know I've grown out of that. But to see books that really reflect who we are, the full breadth of us, I love that. So what made you say, I'm going to be committed to that type of imagery, that type of cover? And I know a lot of people don't have that type of voice when I think of authors. But what made you say, regardless, I'm committed to this type of cover, this type of image of who Black women need to be seen as?
Yeah, I started in traditional publishing. I published like my first four books in traditional publishing and didn't make any money and had very little creative control, little to no control over covers or any of that, which is part of why I started self-publishing. And I loved my career as an indie author. I built my career as an indie author. And so you mentioned me winning the Rita, and of course nobody had done that. It had been 37 years and no Black author had ever done it, even though a Black woman started the organization. Vivian Stevens. And so when I won that award, it was kind of a big deal for our genre, and it changed a lot for me, like overnight. Like I went and I accepted the speech, and by the time, you know, I did an acceptance speech, well, I accidentally deleted whatever I had and I had to come off the dome. And I was like, hey guys, you know, thanks. But by the time I got to the table and had my, you know, I already had emails from people asking me for interviews and all that stuff. So it changed a lot for me. But the big thing was traditional publishers came to me and they were like, come back and, you know, write for us. And I just kind of sat with that. And for like 2 years, I was like, I'm good over here. You know, I really like what I'm doing. I like my creative control. I like, you know, higher royalties. I like all of these things. But one of the things that drew me back was I was in now a different position. And when people talk about, when do you know that you should go to trad and leave indie, or how do you know? And I'm always like, you know, every deal is not created equal. And if you don't have certain assurances that certain things will be in place when you go to traditional publishing, you end up very frustrated because they're in some situations you don't have control over covers or editorial control or promotional control. And so when I came back in, I was in a powerful position. My agent put the book out there and we went to auction. Auction is when you have like 7, 8 publishers vying for that. And when you talk to all the editors and they tell you why you should choose them. And one of the big sticking points for me in every conversation was control of covers, you know, voice in covers. And when I talked to the publisher that I ended up choosing, I was like, I'm telling you now, I want unambiguously Black women on the covers of this series, and I want natural hair, and I specifically said, I want it to be that if someone walked past a billboard and saw this cover, they would be like, look at that Black woman with her big old afro. You know? And the irony is that every book in the Skyland series has been on a billboard. Everyone, Can't Get Enough ended up being on Spotify's billboards in New York and LA. And I was like, Hendrix rounded it out, you know? But it's like, my friend was like, we manifested that. But it means a lot. You know, it means a lot to see ourselves. It's something that I constantly fight for. It's important, so.
Absolutely. We're going to open up for questions, but I have to ask two really quick ones. One, there are some extra, extra spicy scenes in your book. And I tell our customers, you know, they ask, what book should I read? And I recommend this one. But I always feel like I need to smoke a cigarette after I read, and I don't smoke. I'm like, yeah, I be lit. I want to get lit, but I don't. But so I'm just curious, what is your research process for these extra spicy grown-up scenes? I know it's kids in here, so put their little ear pods or something on. But.
You know what? Like, if my husband here, he would be like, oh, my God. I don't know that there's research. I think that there's a certain mindset I have to be in. And sometimes I will just say, sometimes I'm like, how do I clear this search history? how do I make sure that if somebody picks this up, they're not going to see what I'm looking at, you know? But for me, like, I always talk about sex scenes that I see people sometimes say, oh, I just skip sex scenes. I want to write unskippable sex scenes. And what I mean by that is that it's not just about the physical, it's about intimacy, like true intimacy. And those scenes for me always have to move the story forward and they always have to move the relationship forward. And when I'm writing a sex scene, my goal is if somebody skipped this sex scene and they just went to the next chapter, I want them to be like, wait a minute, what happened? Okay, wait, something happened because now they're closer or now they've discovered something about each other or now, you know, he understands something about her he didn't before. And I'm like, yeah, it happened to the sex scene, you know? So that's my goal with sex scenes is I want there to be true intimacy. I want it to deepen the connection and I want it to move the story and the relationship forward. And if I'm not in that space, I'll just, like I'm writing score now and I literally just wrote one, they have sex, okay, next, you know, and I'll just have to come back to it.
I just was curious because as much as I don't smoke, but I was about to smoke. And so we'll open it up for questions, but my last one is what brings you joy? What really, when you close your eyes and think about what joy means, what does it mean for you?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask that because I think that I've been asking myself that a lot. I think, and I've been thinking about the distinction between joy and happiness. As someone who lives with depression, you know, I was diagnosed with depression while I was writing Before I Let Go. I think that joy is something that is insulated from circumstances. I think of happiness as like a bubble that can pop. You know, you lose your job, pop. You know, someone passes away, pop. You know, and that's the fragility of happiness. And I think joy is something that is insulated from circumstances. I think that it is something that, and for me, it's really hugely connected to my faith. You know, that if everything goes away, if I am feeling depressed, joy is something that's different for me. And for me, it has a lot to do with my faith. There's real connection to something that's bigger than I am and something that I feel protected by even when I'm not sure everything's going to be okay. And that is something that gives me like a solid sense of peace and contentment and joy.
And it's so, I feel like joy is in competition with so much negativity that's out here. I mean, it is permeating everything. Yes. It's on the television, it's on social media. So yes. I love that you're feeling that the way you anchor joy in your space is not dependent upon everything around you. So I love that. So I'm going to open it up for questions. I saw people skipping out trying to get to the line already. I see y'all. I saw it. So just if you're patient with me, and we'll just keep our voices down, and I'll just try to call. We'll do a few questions. Okay, family, if y'all gonna exit, just shh. I see y'all. Okay, yes, right here, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll repeat your question. Uh-huh, go ahead.
Congratulations, that's so awesome.
I'm menopausal. I'm trying to remember. So your question was how, as a burgeoning author, how do you balance black love and writing that in stories and balancing it with, what was the last part you said?
Well, I think a lot of times people say that it's not realistic.
That it's not realistic. Right. And how do you balance that?
Right, I get that a lot from people that romance is not realistic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will say, I don't read romance, but I read Kennedy because her romance feels realistic to me. And I'm not saying that as a disparagement to anybody else because I think a lot of people are incorporating things that make it feel real. For me, and I think it's gonna look different for everybody, like you have to figure that out for yourself. For me, because when I'm writing a story, it's usually starting with an issue. You know, like when I wrote a book like Long Shot, which, you know, is the most difficult book I've ever written. I don't have any other book in my catalog like that book. It deals in a very real, raw way with intimate partner abuse. I didn't have these characters in my head. I had this issue in my head, you know, like, and so for me, because I don't often start with story, but I start with discourse. I start with the thing I want to talk about, and then I figure out how to wrap the spice and the swoon and all of those things around that thing. For me, that's the anchor. So there will be elements of a lot of romance novels that are unrealistic. You know, I wrote Can't Get Enough, and he's like a billionaire, and people are like, how many? There's like a very, very, very small percentage of billionaires in the world, much less black billionaires. For me, that's not what I'm asking people to buy into. I'm asking people to buy into the elements that translate to real life, that should translate to real life, which is that you have a partner who supports you, a partner who loves you unconditionally, a partner who will love you through difficult times, a partner who can stay faithful to you, a partner who respects your ambitions and dreams as important as his or hers. You know what I mean? So it's like, there are always fantastical elements. In the context of the genre, the fact that it always ends happily, that is fantastical, because that's not realistic, that's not real life. Things don't always end that way. But it's grounded for me in those things, you know, in what is real about this. And for me, that starts with the discourse. And then it's like, this is not like some high bar. Having a person, in this case, like in this particular book, a man who thinks your ambitions are important, that's not like the bar, you know, that's basic. And so when, especially when men say to me, this is unrealistic expectations, they want you to think that. They want you to think that it doesn't exist, so that in real life you would settle. And so for me, that's the thing, is I'm like, you don't want me to think it's realistic because you don't want me to demand it of you.
Wait, Kennedy, you're preaching.
Your ancestor's story is proof that strength and dignity endure even when everything else is taken away. When it comes to honoring that legacy, your privacy should never be in question. At AfricanAncestry.com, your story and your information belong to you. We destroy every DNA sample and never sell or share your data with anyone. Discover where in Africa your story began, accurately and safely, with AfricanAncestry.com.
Hi, Kennedy. All right, so that is that, you know, that's like this overarching message in a lot of my books is women, don't settle. And that can be, I've been watching like Tracee Ellis Ross, you know, I don't know how many have been watching her solo travel and all of that. And I think that's such an incredible model for us of what it looks like to live a big adventurous life, navigating it as a single woman. And notice I didn't say navigating it alone, because even though she's solo traveling, she talks about her friends and her parents, you know, her family and the community that she has. Like, there is something in culture that tells us that romantic love is more important than everything else, and it's just not true. We've bought into it so that we are willing to starve other areas of our lives and of ourselves in pursuit of romantic love. And I know that sounds weird coming from a romance author, but it's like, that is a very important thing, but also friendship, also family, also making sure that your dreams and your ambitions don't die with you, dormant, because you sacrificed it for someone else in pursuit of less loneliness, you know?
Ooh, the doors of the church are open. You are preaching up in here. We're going to do a Cash App offering in a moment. No. Thank you for sharing that. Next question. Yes, right here out front. I'm going to try to repeat it, so make sure it's a good, succinct question for me. Let me see.
Okay, so one, I love you. So thank you for coming here. My question is, in the book Real, and yeah, also in Can't Get Enough, yeah, there's a kind of like these biases within the black community in general against being darker skinned or being lighter skinned. And one of the parts in Can't Get Enough that really spoke to me was when Hendrix was kind of being talked about by, I can't remember the other girl's name at the present moment.
Oh, Zaire?
Zaire.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Like very bright. So how do you get in the space to talk about those biases within the black community, mm-hmm, of not being enough for your culture, but, mm-hmm, bringing it to the forefront to say, oh, everyone has a different attraction. How do you get in that mind space, right, to write about that and not feel like someone's not going to like it?
So how do you delve into biases in the Black community when it comes to your writing to make sure everybody feels seen and heard? How do you delve into that? Right. And not offend some folks?
Right. I don't think I worry much about offending people. When I do, the offense that I worry about is vulnerable populations and representation that's not mine. So I'm very, very careful with, like I wrote autistic characters. Even though I have a son who's autistic, I hired an actually autistic editor, meaning someone who has autism, to edit the book before I sent it to my publisher. And I interviewed, you know, family members and like families and actually autistic people. When I was writing Real, I was in conversation with so many people who have lupus. Like if there is any kind of representation that's outside of my experience, I'm really, really careful to make sure that I'm not offending someone. My first rule of writing is first do no harm. But what you're talking about is a little different because I'm not thinking about, well, will the light-skinned folks be offended? You know, because you're talking about, and also I don't know that I have to get into a certain mindset when I write it because we all know it's there. You know, that's just the reality of navigating our community. That's the reality of navigating the world. And for me, it's almost incidental. What's really important, when I'm putting it in there, what's really important is how people respond to it. Meaning, when something like that happens, I immediately want to counter it. You know, it's like, if somebody makes a comment like that, I'm not just gonna let it go. You know, Henderson's like, wait, what you talking, you know, wait a minute, hold up, what do you mean I'm not here? You know, even in her mind, she's like, what do you mean I'm not? And Hendrix is someone who is unshakable in her confidence. Like, you're not gonna tell me that I'm not beautiful because I'm darker skinned, you know? And it's interesting because I've been, you know, there's like all this like hoopla over the American Eagle ads and all of those things is, mainstream culture wants us to believe that certain things are by default better. You know, and so we are constantly having to counter that. And I try to do that in my books, like, oh, straighter hair, silkier hair, lighter skin, smaller bodies, well bodies, able bodies are the default and are better. And so I think in my work, I'm just constantly countering that with characters who don't line up with that, but are still obviously so appealing, so attractive, so dynamic, so compelling. So I think that's a big way to counter it is you take all these things that mainstream culture says is not beautiful and you put it into someone who obviously is, you know, and obviously flies in the face of everything you have told us is not the standard. You know, because that's a moving goalpost. So I don't know if that helps or if that makes sense. But it's important to me.
Absolutely. Next question. I see you here, but in the back here with the, Talk loud. I'm going to try to repeat it, girl.
So I'm playing around with my first novel, romance novel.
Okay, first romance novel, yes. Do you fall in love with your characters and how do you find time?
I hope I do. I mean, if you're doing it right, you should fall in love with your characters, you know, because I hope, and that's sometimes when I'm reading, I'm like, this isn't great because I'm not excited about it, you know, and I'll have to go back in and like, what is holding me back from wanting to be in this story all the time and kind of figuring that out, which I mean, obviously my beta readers, I have a lot of people involved. I have alpha readers, beta readers, sensitivity readers, another editor, my publisher, all these people will like help me identify what are those things that are keeping me from falling in love with this story and with this character. I am a voracious reader who doesn't get to read as much as I used to. If you're going to be a writer as a job and not as a hobby, it will require discipline. And it will require sacrifice. You know, that's just like, we have to understand that. When I wrote my first novel, I was working full time and I was running the foundation. And then of course I had a lot of demands with my son. I would wake up 2 hours before everybody else and I would write. And then I would stay up after my husband and my son were going to bed another 2 to 3 hours writing. Not that it has to be 2 to 3 hours every day, but you know, it
takes time. You have to carve out. It's not naturally occurring. And for me, you always have like friends. Once you're an author, you always have friends who are like, oh, I need you to read my book because I need you to blurb and I need you to, and you know, like the other day I just announced like, I'm not doing author blurbs right now. And it's not because I don't want to help you. I'll put you in my newsletter. I'll do this. I'll do that. But like, I don't get to read as much for pleasure. A lot of times when I'm reading, it's for my job. And when I'm writing a book, like the book I'm writing now, there's three memoirs. Like I've read six books to write this book, you know, and that's always, I always have a stack of books that I'm reading to write a book. So, and that's just my process, but it's like, I do use it as a reward. And it's really what pushed me into audiobooks because I don't have a lot of time to read like stuff that I just enjoy. And so after I've done all of that, I'm like, okay, my reward is that I get to listen to my audiobook. You know, I get in bed, I put my earbuds in and, you know, I listen to my audiobook for 30 minutes or whatever. For me, usually it ends up being more than that because you know how you set the 15 minutes so that you, if you fall asleep, you won't miss very much. I end up 15 minutes, another 15 minutes, another 15 minutes. I'm like, okay, I've done 2 hours of 15 minute cycles. And I'm through half this book now, and I'm very sleepy. So I squeeze it in on walks, you know, with that's where audiobooks come in a lot for me. And then when I have a little break, I go on reading sprees, you know, like even if it's just like 2 weeks where I'm not having to write or do these other things, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna squeeze in like books that I wanna read right now. Okay, what did J.L. Seekers just put out? What did Natasha Bishop just put out? What did Daniel Allen just put out? You know, or and my girl, you know, I'm good friends with Emily Henry. What did you put out, Emily, you know? And a lot of times when you do like launch events with other authors, you have to read the book before, you know, and I'm like, okay, I gotta carve out time to read the book before I do this. So reading really becomes a part of your job in a way that it's not when you're reading simply for pleasure, but you get used to it.
I love that.
Good luck.
Right. One last question here. Well, you're this close. Come on up to the mic.
The funny thing is she's just been sitting with her hand just like, she's just like, I'm never going to put my hand down.
I was very serious about getting this question in. Hi, Kennedy. I'm such a fan of your work. Your characters always feel so layered and real, and the emotional depth of your stories really stays with me. I'm curious, what does your writing process look like, especially when it comes to world building and developing your characters? Do you build your characters first and let the world unfold around them, or does the story's world shape your characters more? And also, do you
she said,
like...
And also.
And also.
And however, comma.
And like, do you plan out chapters or do you just start writing certain scenes first?
Right. My process is, so I approach writing a novel the way a journalist probably approaches writing an article, because that's my background. So the first thing I do is I already said I start with discourse. Like, what is the thing, because I don't start with characters usually. I start with what is the thing I want to talk about. And then I start doing research. And so the first thing I do is draft a list of people who are experts in that area or who are living that thing or who have a lot of adjacency to it. I draft a list of people who I need to talk to and I interview. So for my creative process, probably the first, this is gonna sound crazy to people, 2 to 3 months is nothing but interviews. So like for the book that I'm doing now, I have maybe 12 interviews and I record the interviews with them and they're usually about an hour. And then before I start actually writing, I go back and I watch all of the interviews and I start taking notes. And then I will ask them for suggestions of books that I should read and I start building my reading list. And then after that, I read the books that they suggest. And so that's like 2-3 months. And then I'm like, okay, looking at all of this, who is the best person to tell this story? And that's how I start building character. And usually if it's a male, female, who's the woman to tell this story? And then who's the man who deserves her? You know, and then building a man who is worthy of her, building a man who would understand what she's navigating and how he would support, knows how to support her. So it looks a little different for book one, a little bit, because then you establish these secondary characters and it's a little different. different when you get to the next book in a series because those people are established and then you just figure out what is their journey. But I always follow kind of that pattern of interviews, reading, reviewing, and then starting to build the world out of what I've learned, you know?
Kennedy, Renee, Ryan. I just gave you that middle name, Renee. That is not her middle name. But just thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming today. Yes. Yeah. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for making space for us today. Really quickly for the signing. The signing, again, is outside at the orange tent. There's a Mahogany Books pop-up banner right behind it. There are some people on our team there to guide you. But thank you all for coming out. Wait, before y'all leave, I want to take a selfie.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.